ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife Science.
Goodness me, is it that time of week already? It's time to talk all the weird, the wonderful, the sizzling news from the scientific world. And who better to do that with this Monday evening than Charlie Lineweaver? He's an astrophysicist at the ANU's Research School of Astronomy and Astrophysics. Charlie, good evening.
Good evening, Chris. Science.
I always love a science segment where we have a world first. And first up tonight, we do have a world first, a brain implant that's letting a man speak and sing with expression in real time.
Yeah, this is something that, you may have been familiar with Stephen Hawking, and you heard he had a motor neuron disease, and he would use it like a cheek muscle that was still working, and he would click it up and down, and he would click, there would be a cursor, and it was very primitive, and then he'd talk like this, very monotone, right? Well, this new stuff, the world first, is much more advanced than that, and that is a similar victim of motor neuron disease. He can't talk. He can't say what he wants to say. So what they did was they put some, silicon, have you ever seen an EEG, an electroencephalogram? They put magnets and pieces of metal on your scalp. Well, this is something that is embedded in your brain, so you get a much more detailed EEG, a much more detailed, what is this cell saying, or what are the electrical impulses? And so it picks up the electrical impulses very spatially detailed. And then by training, the guy has, he knows what he wants to say. And then he tries to say it, he can't. But then the computer tries to figure out what he's saying. And then he kind of trains it by saying, yeah, that's what I wanted to say. And so after he trained this thing, I'm not sure how long it went on, maybe a couple of years.
All right.
But what was most important was, right now, when you're speaking, people do not talk like this. They're not monotone. There's a lot of expression and emotion in it. And this new way of doing it includes the emotion. And that's what's the big advance here. So here's a guy who couldn't talk. Now he can talk. And get this, it's in real time. So the pickups inside of his brain are doing it every 10 milliseconds. So he tries to talk, and he's talking as he's trying. So it's in real time. That is also something very, very different from Stephen Hawking.
There was a delay with Stephen Hawking where he typed and then it...
It was a terrible delay. He would he'd ask him a question, then 10, you know, maybe a minute, 5 minutes later, no.
How extraordinary.
So anyway,
It is. And when you say with expression, like, does he sound like you and I, like completely indistinguishable from, you know, regular human speech? Or is there still a slight, you know, slight monotone? Or is it pretty good?
It's not as, I wouldn't call it a monotone. I would call it a little bit of a hesitation, kind of like, well, what do you want me to do? Or something like that. So it goes up and down, it's expressive, but it's a little bit slow. It's not as quick. You and I are talking. We're professionals here. We're talking on the radio. But this guy, I don't know if he could talk as fast as we are doing now, but normal voice. So
yeah, I don't know if anybody can speak as fluidly and colorfully as you, Charlie.
Now, you know, what's incredible here is much better than it used to be, especially if you're used to Stephen Hawking, and it'll only get better. What's a little bit weird is that the guy has two boxes about the size of, your thumb on top of his head that is kind of where – that leads the electrodes into his head. Now, I imagine that I think people are working on miniaturizing that whole thing so there won't be this invasive boxes and you won't even, and if you can't, it's kind of like the brain. If it can't talk to your muscles in your throat, then you can't speak. But this computer with the artificial training has enables him to speak. And it's kind of like his real voice. They trained the computer on his real voice. You know how they imitate people, you know, with artificial intelligence. Yes. Now they can get Trump to say whatever they want him to say, or Obama. And this is what they can do with people who are injured and really help them out. He's really... I would say he says, I feel happy.
Yeah. So that's a huge breakthrough. So it sounds like at the moment it's just only he that has access to this, but it won't be long before they can roll this out for anyone who requires this technology.
I think that's the case. I'm not sure. This was done at the University of California, Davis, and a lot of people are working on this, but the most important thing is not being too invasive about your brain. You don't want to mess around too much with your brain, but I think if they miniaturize it a lot more, it'll be a lot more helpful. full, and the computers are getting better.
Now, talking about computers coming to the aid of not just human speech, they're also coming to the aid of art. Apparently, computers are at the forefront of helping restoration of damaged oil paintings.
Yeah, this is an interesting story that just came out this week. It's by an MIT researcher, and he starts out this article by saying that about 70% of artworks are not being displayed by museums. And the reason is, and they're getting lots and lots of artwork from, you know, kind of rich people who have, you know, family heirlooms, but they're a little bit damaged. And, you know, they don't like to display things that are partially damaged. Well, what this new technique for restoring, well, let me go back, say, you know, if you're going to restore something, it's very, very expensive. You have to have some expert who knows the painting and knows the painter and knows the paints. And they sit there with a tiny, tiny brush and touch things up. And it's incredibly expensive, incredibly time consuming. But here's the new way that this guy figured out how to do. So you get this painting that's partially damaged in multiple thousands of places, and then you do a very, very detailed scan of it, all right? So you have your scan, then you put it on your computer, and then you say, okay, I'm going to touch it up on my computer. And so what you do, you like touch it up, you know, matching the colors. Oh, that's not right. Oh, that's better. Oh, and so you do that online on your computer. And then what you do is you create the thing that the way it should look. Mm. And then you subtract the way it does look, and that gives you a mask. And that mask is then converted into a film with all these very, very subtle colors. That film is then put on top of the original, and that fills in all of the thousands and thousands of places where paint is flicked off and there's a scratch, etc. And then it makes it just like, whoa, you've restored it. And you've done it in a couple of hours as compared to a couple of days or months.
So is any paint itself being used, or is it all the computer?
No. It's not all computer. I don't think there's any paint being used, but what is being used is a film that has the colors that the computer has told the film to have, so that when you place this film, it's like a layer on top of the painting looks like, oh, it's all fixed now.
Extraordinary.
So it's kind of like doing the fixing online and then putting it in one layer on top of the painting that's damaged, and that they, oh, you fix the painting in one with one layer of film with thousands of different colors that you have created online.
I wonder if they can also apply this technology to, you know, all those sort of, you know, botched frescoes in Spain. You know, the Jesus fresco in Spain that was in a church and it ended up looking like a monkey after the restoration.
Yes, yes.
It sort of made global headlines. I wonder if this technology could avert those disasters in the future.
Well, if it's two-dimensional, I imagine yes. As long as you can put your film into, if it's a curved surface, for example, if you can produce curved film, I don't see why not. I think after they do this maybe a couple hundred, a thousand times to artworks that are only worth, I don't know, $1,000 rather than $1 million, then you'll plus the museums will have a lot more to display, and that's kind of exciting because it's very nice to see some of the detailed ones that we haven't seen before.
That's true. Yes, so many of the great museums collections are in the vaults. You know, as you said, 70 or 80% of them, I think. We're talking science with Charlie Lineweaver this evening on Nightlife, right around the country on ABC Radio. Now, talk to me about Manu jumping.
So I am an astronomer, and on a Viking cruise. I'm the Viking. Oh, sometimes I go on cruises, and recently I went to Auckland, and when I was walking around the harbor in Auckland, I saw these people having the greatest time jumping off of about something like 5 meter high, right? And they were jumping off, and they're having what I would call a cannonball contest, just so you can make the biggest splash. And I was watching, everybody's having so much fun. There were little guys and fat guys and all kinds of people doing it. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I've never seen that before. Well, just recently, there has been, now, this is apparently is a sport. The Maori and the Pacific Islander people are the ones who are, I guess, who are really fans of this sport. And this, I guess, a group of fluid dynamicists from, I guess, in Atlanta, they saw this and said, boy, they're having so much fun. What are they trying to do? So they're trying to make the biggest splash. How do you make the biggest splash? And you'll see them. They don't do what I would call a cannonball. What they do is they kind of like, they're going to do a back. You know how you do a belly flop?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you do the opposite, you do a back flop, right? And it looks like they're going to come down and do a back flop. But then at the last minute, they raise their legs and raise their upper body, and they enter the water in a V shape. And this V shape apparently maximizes the splash that they make. But then they figure. But now here's the thing. You know, these guys who do fluid dynamics, they, I guess they've been employed by Olympic divers for the least amount of splash.
I was about to say, the one thing I know about Olympic diving is you don't want any splash. So they've inverted what all these Olympic divers have learned. And
that's right. That's what makes it so much fun. The big splash is so much more fun than a little ripple.
So anyway, you want to aim to land on your back rather than your belly, but at the 11th hour, if you coordinated enough to negotiate this, to suddenly stop doing a backbreaker but get your legs in the air in a V.
Yes, that's right. But now that seems to be the technique that works the best. But I forgot the most important thing that they discovered is what you do under the water after you've landed in the water. So you can't just land as a V and then just go into a blob. You have to do some kind of back roll. So the whole point is to keep the pocket of air that you've inserted into the water, make that as big and as deep as possible by flipping somehow that I don't understand. And then boom. Now what this reminds me of is when I was like, I don't know, 15 or so, exactly. I used to go up to a cliff with a crowbar in Canada, and we would make gigantic boulders fall into the water. And I've never seen such a gigantic splash because the boulder, when it fell, it made such a big hole in the water that boom, it would just come together and make a splash that went 30, 40 meters high. I said, whoa, that's incredible. Anyway, that's what they try to do. They can jump from 5 meters and they can make splashes 10 meters high. So these guys are real champions, and there's a whole championship. This is kind of like a bungee jumping. That too was invented, I think, in New Zealand. So these New Zealanders have a penchant for inventing interesting, funny and new sports. And there's a championship now. As a matter of fact, I was looking at the webpage. I think they're giving $40,000 for
the biggest splash.
And it's not just the biggest splash. It's also the most style and also the loudest. They have hydrophones. They have microphones underneath the water to see who makes the biggest sound. So it's interesting. It's not just the big fat guys who do this. I was impressed by seeing just little guys make gigantic splashes. Anyway, I'm not sure if they have weight classes or what, but anyway, the guys.
I love this. This is you know, proof positive that there's not a single corner of the world's knowledge that science hasn't turned its mind to, including making the biggest splash. I don't know what the teenage audience of nightlife is, but if there's lots of teenage boys or girls listening to this, they will be so thrilled that come summer and if they want to start bombing in the pool that they've finally got the scientific evidence behind them to make the biggest splash possible. Charlie, thank you for reminding us how interesting our world is. It's always a pleasure. You have a great night.
Okay, and get those bombs, those V-bombs. Pop some manos this summer.
That's Charlie Lineweaver. He's an astrophysicist at the ANU's Research School of Astronomy and Astrophysics.
Nightlife Science.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.